Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Well, it is just under 2 weeks until Donald Trump returns to the White House, and in a broad-ranging press conference yesterday, the president-elect pledged to roll back environmental restrictions, pardon supporters who stormed the US Capitol, and revealed plans to impose military and economic pressure in order to expand US territory. Well, he spared his most chilling remarks for areas of foreign policy, warning that all hell would break loose in the Middle East if all Israeli hostages were not returned by the time he's back in office. Now, Hamas has stood by its demand that Israel fully end its assault on Gaza under any deal to release hostages. Israel has been holding talks with Qatari and Egyptian mediators in the most intensive effort for months to reach a ceasefire. Joining me now for analysis is Lise Doucette, Chief International Correspondent with the BBC. Lise, good morning to you and thank you for joining us. We've spoken before about the hell that's already being experienced by the people in Gaza. Donald Trump's remarks, do you see them as a threat or a statement of intent in respect to the Middle East?
Well, he used a similar phrase, Claire, during his election campaign, all hell will break out. And yesterday he made it clear that it wasn't just around Gaza, it would be across the Middle East. So yes, it is a threat, but this is his second time in office. People know how unpredictable he is. That sometimes he uses very powerful words and doesn't act on them. But he's already showing that this time round, he means it when he says it. He also, though, said that he didn't want to get in the way of negotiations. And as you mentioned, the very fact of this pressure that he has said he wants all of the hostages, and there's believed to be about 100 of the more than 250 which were seized on that terrible day of October the 7th when Hamas militants went on the rampage across southern Israel. It's not clear how many are still alive. And yes, it is, to use phrases that are used by the United Nations day in, day out, that it is a living hell for Palestinians living in it, Gaza, which now lies in ruin. But Trump's pressure seems to have injected some new urgency into these talks, which have been going on for many, many months now. And his own newly appointed Middle Eastern envoy has said that he's going to join these negotiations, never mind that the Trump administration is not in power yet, but already they seem to be sitting at some of the tables. We understand they're narrowing the gaps, but the gaps which exist are still on some fundamental points, and they're not there yet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, given what you've just explained, that the negotiations have intensified in recent times, it's hard to see what Donald Trump would do after his first day in office in this regard, because it does seem unlikely that American troops would join the IDF, for example, on the ground in Gaza. So what options are available to him?
Well, the United States has a vast arsenal of military might. With Donald Trump, you just don't know. I mean, you may remember that in his first term in office, one of his first acts was to drop one of the most powerful bombs in the U.S. arsenal, called it's usually known by its acronym, Mother of All Bombs. It dropped in eastern Afghanistan. It was meant to target remnants of the Islamic State. It certainly made a very loud noise, left a large crater, but really didn't do much when it came to trying to eliminate what was left of the Islamic State. So he may want to make some kind of a statement. And don't forget, there's also the Israeli side of it too. He seems to have a very close personal and political relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu, but the Israeli leaders also know that he can turn on a dime and say, well, you too have to do much more to end the war. And what we're seeing now is that there's a lot of discussion now about a partial deal, a temporary ceasefire. Partly it's said because Prime Minister Netanyahu is still saying he doesn't want to end the war until, as he sees it, he ends Hamas. His own military chiefs months ago had said that they believe they've achieved all they can militarily, but he seems to be pushing forward. His the far right members of his cabinet keep saying as well, they don't want this war to end for a partial deal. And on the side of Hamas, their red lines have not changed. They want an end to this war. They don't want just to stop for a while and then go back. They also want Israeli troops to leave the Gaza Strip. And Israel is still saying it wants to keep some in a corridor, the Philadelphia corridor along the border with Egypt. There's also a question of whether they'd have them in a new kind of dividing line between North and South Gaza. So these are still the last very, very hard issues to resolve. And of course, it's the fate of the hostages. A new list was produced recently, and there was some confusion. Was it a Hamas list? Was it an Israel list? And there were accusations on both sides. So it isn't over until it's over, mm-hmm. sadly.
Now, elsewhere, his other comments. I mean, you're Canadian, I know. I'm just interested to hear how you view his comments about land grabs and power grabs in Canada and Greenland, the Panama Canal and so on. What do you think?
Well, even before this press conference where he dropped all these political bombshells, he had been referring to Prime Minister Trudeau, who resigned this week, as the governor of Canada. He referred to Canada as the 51st state. So he was already in that, making it in a joking kind of way. But these are not jokes for Canadians. And now he has toughened that language, saying that Canada should, that he would not, he said he wouldn't use military force to try to take Canada over, but he would use economic force. And that is a real threat to Canada. We saw it in the first term because the vast, vast majority of Canada's trade goes through the United States. And it would be absolutely devastating for the Canadian economy if he was to impose, for example, the kind of crippling sanctions he's talking about for China, anywhere from 60% to 100%. Trump and his team have even been posting maps on social media showing that Canada is part of the United States. I was watching one this morning with someone, not Trump himself, but someone was pointing out that if you put Canada, Mexico, and the United States together, it would be the third most populous country in the world and the mightiest of all. And people are not just taking it as jokes anymore, mm-hmm. this second time round. But Canadians are already responding to it. What can be done? I mean, it's something, it's, people are watching this very, very nervously. The people of Greenland, the people around the Panama Canal, the people in Canada. And many are asking, what next?
What next, indeed. Lise, thank you very much. Lise Doucette there. And they're very interested in what's being said by Donald Trump in Greenland too, where Donald Trump Jr. has paid a flying visit. I'm joined on the line by Graham Butler, who's a full professor of law at the University of Southern Denmark. Graham, thank you for being with us this morning. Just
Good morning, Claire.
To give us a sense of this, Greenland is a self-governing part of the Danish kingdom, isn't it? Can you explain the relationship to us?
Yeah, exactly. So the Danish kingdom is obviously forms part of Denmark, as we all know, a fellow member state like Ireland, but it also includes two autonomous territories or self-governing territories, the Faroe Islands being one, and obviously Greenland, which is in the news today. Denmark is an EU member state. Greenland is treated in the EU as an overseas country and territory because of its self-governing status. It has a lot of internal autonomy and self-rule for what it does. It has its own government. But because it's part of the kingdom, it also has members of the Danish parliament and so forth. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, in the context of what we're talking about at the moment, Denmark is responsible for, I suppose, three main areas, which are all interrelated. One of their foreign policy, security policy, and defence policy are a matter for Denmark. And that is why Denmark is particularly concerned at the moment, because, I mean, it's not unprecedented for America to have interest in Greenland, but they're allies. They're Denmark has been part of NATO with the US for a long time. The Danish military forces buy predominantly US-made equipment as opposed to European equipment, the same way the French or the Germans do. So Denmark has tied itself to the West through the United States for a long time. Mm-hmm. But this is... But I mean, just in terms of the political reaction to it, how it's been, I think that's important. I mean, it's the comments of the president-elect are gathering a lot of interest. But within Denmark here, it's a lot more muted, I would say. The prime minister has Prime Minister of Denmark has been quite steadfast and said, you know, the US is an ally, they'll always be our allies, and the matters of Greenlandic rule is a matter for Greenland itself. It's Greenland decide what they want to be a part of, whether they want to continue to be a part of the Danish kingdom, whether they want to be an independent territory. And they've always been the two options, really. And for since the 19th century, they've been part of the Danish kingdom. And nothing has majorly moved forward to any sort of change. But the fact that now there's active discussion about a third way or a third option here, that is certainly new in any sort of serious
right. And sense. Is it fair to say there has been a renewed interest in Greenland of late because of its natural resources, that people are looking at it with new eyes?
Yeah, that's been on the table for some time. The ties between Denmark and Greenland are longstanding, but I think as much as the natural resources because of evolving climate change might be of interest, I think it's also important to look at the predominant US position. This is the position of a new administration. When the president-elect was previously president, he took an interest, as the previous speaker just saying. But we have to look at this as part of a bargaining chip. There's a lot of bluster, as the previous speaker mentioned, about what is said and then what is actually done in practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just have to look at the president-elect's interest in Europe. What is he interested in? Is he interested in trade matters, trade deficits, Europe becoming more responsible for its own defence? But also you have to look at the role of the digital market. You have to look at the leader of certain social media companies and look at their relationship to the US. Europe has particularly strong regulation here. The interest that the new administration might have in Greenland is just one thing that he'll take an interest in many member states in the coming years and use them as a bargaining chip for negotiations or whatever comes to pass.
Okay, well, Graham, thank you very much for running us through it. Graham Butler there from the University of Southern Denmark. Now, we want to look at some other issues that have come to the top of the agenda ahead of Donald Trump's inauguration. Meta's decision to end its fact-checking programme that was introduced in 2016 to help tackle misinformation right across the company's platforms, including Facebook and Instagram. John Isle, Deputy Business Editor with Sunday Times Ireland, is on the line now. So, John, this decision is being viewed as an effort by Mark Zuckerberg, the Meta CEO, to stay on the right side, really, of Donald Trump as he goes back in to the White House. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Oh, I think absolutely. It's quite transparent, given the steps that he's taken, who exactly he's trying to appeal to. I saw a headline this morning that said, Zuckerberg makes Meta worse to please Trump. And I think that really sums it up. And he's not the only one who's doing it. We're familiar with the moves that Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has made as well. And Elon Musk, of course, is part of the Trump inauguration team and backed the president-elect with $250 million of his own money to help fund the Republican campaign leading up to the American election in November. So just looking at the sort of talking points in Meta's announcement about removing fact checkers, and as Zuckerberg said, there was too much censorship on the platform. Those are all Republican talking points, or the sort of talking points you hear from the Trump team. And it's very clear that Zuckerberg is trying to conform to a Republican idea of how a social media platform should operate.
Mm-hmm. So they've all looked then at Elon Musk and his relationship with Donald Trump, the influence he's likely to have in the White House, and they've said, well, we want a piece of that, so we're going to play the game.
Exactly. And you can look at it one way and say, well, Zuckerberg is being rational. He's looking at the facts before him and saying, if I want my company to continue to succeed, I'll have to play by the rules of the game, that is about to start after Inauguration Day. That's fine. He's the third wealthiest person in the world also, and has considerable leverage, I think, both culturally and economically. So I do believe other choices were available to him. What will be interesting to see is actually how the platform evolves in terms of its users, because this is a decision that was made at the top that I don't think really had users in mind. Others might disagree, but that happens to be my view. But what it suggests to me in terms of the business environment in the United States, and this will probably bleed over to the rest of the Western world as well, is that the free market isn't quite as free as it was before, because you have a very powerful actor in Donald Trump who is willing to put his thumb on the scale. So it won't just be one social media platform competing against another one for eyeballs and users and advertising dollars. but there will be favored platforms and disfavored platforms. And I would imagine that what these guys are doing, Zuckerberg, Musk, etc., are positioning themselves to be looked upon favorably by the regulatory state when it comes time for Trump and his people to start making decisions in Washington, D.C.
John, thank you very much. John Isle there from the Sunday Times Ireland. Coming up next, we're going to have an update on the weather conditions around the country.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.